So back to stories, just real quick, kind of 10 steps to a better story. If you learn anything as a speaker, the ability to tell stories, I mean, that's half your battle. Personal stories are the best, but when you start looking at developing your talks, if you don't have a story, where can you go? Family and friends? Are there some good books out there of stories? 80 million copies sold of Chicken Soup for the Soul. All right, know exactly why you're telling. Even if a story has grabbed your attention, it has nothing to do with what you're talking about, it has no relevance at all, what does your audience do? They listen, but then what do? They're like, what did that have to do with anything? It kind of throws them off course. Use the hook of the story to transition back into your presentation. Great time to get serious is right after a laugh. Get your body and emotions into the story. If you're not sure if your story is going to work, if they're not going to laugh, if they're not going to feel emotions, don't do it or practice it. Good stories can take 5 or 10 minutes. Vivid and accurate. We've talked about people that have told stories that weren't completely true that'll hurt you in the long run. Don't condescend to your audience and make sure the stories fit your style. Because you can crank up emotions in a story. Personal story. Get the audience to laugh, to cry, and the easiest way is through stories. And something I'd recommend that you do as you become master speakers is start writing down experiences when they come to your mind. It could be a growing up experience, a family experience, a camping experience, a high school experience. It's whatever it is, write them down, because it's amazing how many stories you have. A lot of you are saying, well, I don't have any stories. You have stories. You just need to write them down, you need to remember them. And when you have a list of a couple hundred stories, you can kind of reference those when you're giving talks. What are things that create emotions in a story? Details, but I mean, like events that we can all relate to that are very emotional. Death, birth, illness, serious illness, life, love, ambitions. Yeah, I guess if your audience can relate to that, depending on what type of the ambition was. If you were talking to a group of Olympic athletes, that ambition to get the gold medal would be something very emotional for them. Embarrassing moments, people can relate to. So emotions are very powerful. Okay, examples. Few of you, that was the next one. Make them vivid and concrete. We talk what we call, you paint the picture. What do I mean by paint the picture? You're telling, you're painting it. When people talk, you can see yourself there, you can taste it, you can feel it. I was working with a lady once I was talking about, it's critical to paint this picture so people, if you paint the picture well enough, you could get people to throw up. Get people to cry. And she's all, yeah, right, uh-huh. I'm like, you can. I mean, you can create these type of things. You get people to cry, to throw up and these things. She's all, uh-huh. I go, are you daring me? She's all, yeah, I'm daring you. So I won't go into detail because many of you have eaten dinner, but no, I don't want anything on the floor. I went into full detail. This was back during the Zuka juice. I went into full detail about and I knew one of her weaknesses was certain habits of cats, because she had stepped in something in her home. But I went into full detail about a cat poop Zuka. About how it was blended and some of the hairs got stuck in the straws and the cat litter at the bottom. I won't go into more detail, but some of you are already starting to cringe as she started to suck on the claw and the straw and the hairs were. I won't go anybody.
Was she drinking?
She wasn't drinking. I know she was a Zuka fan, but I knew she had a thing with cats because you can set the tone with that. And we'll talk about verbal packaging and that later on. But paint the picture, clarify, reinforce your ideas, personalize your ideas. They're very powerful. So examples: vivid and richly textured. They can be brief. They can be hypothetical. And this just really paints a picture in your speech. So if you're going to talk about overcoming the fear of flying, what type of example would you use?
Did they have a thing
that would be a great example. Someone that had the same exact fear, is afraid to get on a plane, and now that they've overcome it after going through your course and spending $1,995 to do that. How about the importance of stopping pollution? Maybe someone who died. Could also be, you ever had your sink clogged with hair, food, and just quit draining. That's what air pollution is doing to us. It's what it's doing to your lungs. It's filling up with gunk. That's an example. There you go. All right. I'll stop. You can give these looks, Painting the picture. How about television viewing is a waste of time? Television can be that undetected cancer that just starts unsuspectedly. You just sit there and just starts to grow. Paint the picture. Critical. Paint the picture. Again, they can be brief. They can be hypothetical. You know, whether you're doing rat infestation, or for example, one of my favorite, we talk about, because I'm a big believer in personal development. I say personal development's like a bucket with a hole in it. You know, if you're not replenishing and always learning, and it'll eventually dry up. And that picture, that example, just kind of rings true for people. It's easier for things to understand. Again, an example would be a parable that Christ used. All right, we've talked about statistics. Again, make sure that they're believable, that you know where they came from. You know, if you found out that research study on campus showed that they wanted to cut the men's basketball team, but you found out the research was done by the men's rugby team, you know, there's kind of a conflict of interest there. So explain your statistics. For example, when you say, as a country, I'm just guessing here, we're $5 trillion in debt, does that mean anything to you? It's a big number. What is it, though? Can anybody put $1 trillion into perspective? We can use it for a lot of good reason. I mean, it's a lot of money, though, but how do you get the audience to realize how much money that is? Yeah, you could do something like that. The one I wrote down one was that, here it is, if you had $1 million and spent it at the rate $1,000 a day, you'd run out of money in 3 years. If you had $1 billion and spent $1,000 a day, you'd run out of money in 3,000 years. If you had $1 trillion and spent $1,000 a day, you'd run out of money in 3 million years. Now you're like, ouch. No, that's real. That's true. That is true. Unlike the cat poop zooka, that one's true. And it's also nice sometimes to round off your complicated numbers. Instead of saying the moon is 238,855 miles from the Earth, you know, just say it's 239,000. Other way, it gets kind of tricky. So complicated, round off your complicated number. Testimony. So there's an expert testimony. You can bring somebody in, somebody that's in the field. Your personal testimony or a peer testimony. Peer testimony would be like a commercial. It says, my neighbor Linda uses Febreze fabric softener, and that's peer. So you have expert, yourself, and peer testimony. The three different types of testimonies that you have. All right. Other type of support you can use, metaphors, comparisons, findings, just a few of the others. And of course, along with this, analyzing your audience is knowing what to wear. Of course, the power colors for men, or anybody actually, what are the two power colors? Blue and black. Women. Red a lot of times. It also depends on the group, too. Things are a lot. When I started speaking, it was always a suit. Now it's a lot more casual to wear. A lot of times you still wear a jacket, but you don't have to have a tie. So things have... Have you noticed in the business world that things are more casual? In your corporate jobs, things are a lot more casual, so that's part of it, too. Now, also as speakers, you need to know how to motivate people. I mean, as a speaker, don't you want to motivate your audience to do something? What is motivation?
Wanting to do something?
Yourself? Are you always motivated?
No.
Aren't you? If you're sitting in front of the TV doing nothing, isn't that what you're motivated to do? In a way, right? Motivation comes from the word motive. So it's critical for you to understand, as master speakers, the world of motivation and how it works. Because we've heard all the term motivational speakers, there's coaches that are motivating. What is it that takes it to motivate a crowd? I tell you, there's nothing more invigorating to have 2,000 people just kind of exciting and motivating. But then you don't want to motivate them too much, and they go home and they're so motivated they don't know what to do. I mean, that happens. Sometimes you need to give them something to do. So let's talk about motivation. Let's draw a little diagram how it works. See, motivation's always fascinated me. I've spent years studying the psychology of motivation, being a motivational speaker and talking about people. And you come to a convention or an audience and you're excited and you're talking about people. These things are going to change their life, like goal setting or whatever it is. And you're excited, I'm going to do that. And they go home, and what happens?
It's gone.
You know, I talk to people afterwards. They say, oh, that was great. I'm going to change my life. I go, okay, let's exchange some emails. And, of course, you know, some people would change, but most people wouldn't. We all want to be financially independent. We all want great relationships. We all want to be fit. And I go out to anybody on the street and say, excuse me, sir, would you like to be financially independent? What are they going to say? Oh, sure, I would love that. Well, what are you doing about it? You know, and we want these things. We have all these desires and wishes, but for the most part, it always boggled my mind. I thought, am I wasting my life? Why can't we get ourselves to do the things that we really want to do, even when we don't feel like doing them? So I poured into research, trying to figure it out what it was, and I figured it out. Do you want the answer? Give me the answer. And this is not only important for you in your life, but as future master motivators and master speakers, you need to learn how to motivate. And there's just not one type of motivator. There's a couple different types. In fact, let me diagram it for you, and I'll bill you later. First of all, we have this little area in here called our comfort zone, right? We're creatures of habit. Everyone agree with that? Why are we creatures of habit? Why is change a four-letter word? We like order. It's comfortable. It's easier. Even if it's more painful, we know the pain, and we tend to do that. And sometimes get stuck in what I call a digression cycle. But first of all, there are only two motivators in life. There's only two. Do we know what they are? Inspiration and desperation. That's it. Only two motivators that exist. You agree with that? Only two. See, but a lot of times, most people use desperation as a motivator. And sometimes we get stuck in that what we call a digression cycle. Let's say you have a high school reunion coming up. 5-year, 10-year, 20-year high school reunion, whatever it is. And you've been eating a lot of that Ben and Jerry stuff. A lot of that Pizza Hut stuff. And your pants don't fit very well. You are going to make sure your pants... So you know, you're in this comfort zone. And, you know, you work on yourself. You're losing the weight. You're losing the weight. You go to the reunion. And you work on yourself just enough so the pants fit. But then after the reunion, what happens? After the reunion? Go back into the comfort zone. So it's kind of a digression cycle going again and again and again. And so what we need to do is break free from that. But those are the only two motivators in life. And they can be either internal or external. Explain how this works. Because as a great speaker, you'll want to pepper your presentation with different types of motivators. Some people are more motivated by desperation. Some people are more motivated by inspiration. Let's take external desperation, or you can write in the word fear. I can motivate anybody. You know that? I can motivate anybody. Believe me? Anybody know any lazy teenagers? Anybody? Is anybody in this room ever a lazy teenager? I can motivate them. Take them out in the middle of the lake. I'll throw them out. Hold their head underneath the water and hold it there with all my might, and what am I going to see besides bubbles? Struggle or motivation, right? They're motivated, right? Because desperation is rooted out of logic. I mean, it's very temporary, because once they get that breath of air, what do they turn back into? Lazy teenager. It's motivated. I mean, and that's what it is. The next is internal desperation. We'll call it obligation. Obligation or duty. Let's take your job, for example. Let's say you go to work out of fear, because if you don't go to work, you'll get fired. If you get fired, you won't be able to pay your bills. You won't pay your bills. Or you could do it out of internal desperation or obligation. You said you'd be there. There's a project that you're working on. There's other employees that you're working with that you need to help out. Deep down, you don't want to go, but out of internal desperation, you go anyway. Okay? If you spend your life over here, you'll never be happy, you'll never be successful, you'll never accomplish your goals. Guaranteed. What you want to do is get people over to the inspiration side. Let's take external inspiration, or we'll call it respect, or love. You go to work out of external inspiration, you're going to provide the best for your family, to send your children to the best schools, to take your spouse on a cruise, to get a better home for your family. That's external inspiration. Pretty good, but the best is internal inspiration or that passion. And that's where you want to tap in. If you can tap into your own passion, other people's passion, you're no longer leaving an alarm clock. Your passion, you met people like this. They're just going, they're excited about life, they don't need to be motivated. And if you can tap into this, you'll see a big difference in your motivation and the things that you want to accomplish and the things that you want to do. You have to find the right reasons to be able to do that. And as a speaker, you'll probably want to pepper some different things within your presentation. If you were going to talk about the joy of warts. Fear, what would be your fear? Getting warts is going to make you ugly. You won't get any dates and you'll never be married. What would be the passion? Again, strange subject. What would be the passion? joy of warts. Okay, I picked the hardest one. Your passion would be, imagine staying wart-free. How excited you'll be to wake up in the morning and not have any warts on your body and be able to choose from any man or woman that you want. Okay, I'm stretching it here, but I think you get the idea. A lot of people are motivated with desperation, but you want to spend more time with the inspiration. Inspiration is rooted out of emotion. We're emotional creatures. There's some saying, oh, I'm a logical person. We are emotional creatures, I can guarantee you. We make decisions based on emotion. So, these are external forces, things around us. And then the internal comes from within. Let me read this. It's all in the story. Big city Democratic lawyer went duck hunting in rural Texas. How many Texans here? A few Texans. He shot it and dropped a bird, but it fell into a Republican farmer's field on the other side of the fence. As the lawyer climbed over the fence, an elderly farmer drove up on his tractor and asked him what he was doing. The litigator responded, I shot a duck and it fell in this field, and now I'm going to retrieve it. The old farmer replied, this is my property and you are not coming over here. The indignant lawyer said, I'm one of the best trial attorneys in the U.S., and if you don't let me get that duck, I'll sue you and take everything you own. The old farmer smiled and said, apparently you don't know how we do things in Texas. We settle small disagreements like this with the Texas three-kick rule. The lawyer asked, what is the Texas three-kick rule? The farmer replied, well, first, I kick you 3 times, and then you kick me 3 times, and so on, back and forth until someone gives up. The attorney quickly thought about the proposed contest and decided that he could easily take the old codger. He agreed to abide by the local custom. The old farmer slowly climbed down from the tractor and walked up to the city feller. His first kick planted the toe of his heavy work boot into the lawyer's groin and dropped him to his knees. The second kick nearly ripped the man's nose off his face. The barrister was flat on his belly when the farmer's third kick to the kidney nearly caused him to give up. The lawyer summoned every bit of his will, managed to get to his feet, and said, okay, you old coot, now it's my turn. The old farmer smiled and says, nah, I give up. You can have the duck. That's how you say it. Stories are great. Let's spend time with hecklers. We love hecklers, right? First of all, why do people heckle? They're hecklers. That's what they're supposed to do, right? They have nothing else to do. They heckle. What causes people to heckle? Tension, that would be one. What else? Get bored. Alcohol. Yes, we talked about alcohol. It could be a bad day. They could not like you. I mean, there's a lot of things. People will heckle you. In fact, in political speeches, they call it bracketing, where they actually hire hecklers and send them out to other people's political speeches. It's called bracketing. There's a name for it. But the problem is, if you handle a heckler well, what does that do to you and your credibility? You actually get more points if you handle it the right way. If you handle it the wrong way and get upset, start pulling out to your bird friends and saying things that you shouldn't, what does that do to your credibility? You're gone. I mean, hecklers will make or break you, and you will have hecklers, because my broad scope of hecklers, it could be a cell phone, it could be a baby crying, it could be someone standing up calling you names. These are all hecklers.
What
sure.
What has been your
worst heckling experience?
Yeah.
The guy in New York City, I had physically removed. He was kept going off and off.
What?
And I had, he was just, I don't know if he was mentally not there, he was upset about something, but he had something negative to say about everything. And you know, and I'm talking about the different stages of handling hecklers, and the last stage is actually have them removed, have security come. And luckily I had an off-duty New York City police officer that kindly threw some muscle around and got the gentleman out of the room. I told you the one with the mistress. That was bad. Fire alarms going off. I don't know if I told you, I spoke at a chiropractic convention. It was my first getting started. I spoke during dinner. And, you know, people were ordering and things. It was just hectic. Overlooking the beach at Santa Barbara with an all-male group. Consider that heckling. So basically, heckling could be any type of distraction. A lot of times you'll get people that want to be the know-it-all, want to prove you wrong. It's just how you handle them. You know, they might have had a long day if they have a full dinner. But I mean, the main thing to handle a heckler is what? What does the heckler want to get from you? Reaction. They want to upset you, they want to throw you off, and they want to ruin your day. And if you don't let those things happen, most of the time, most hecklers will give up. And that's one thing to remember, is most hecklers, totally clueless. Most of the thing, like, you know, that's probably not a good thing to do when someone's speaking, but hecklers, as you know, are clueless. They have no idea that they're annoying the class with their questions. They have no idea they're being rude. Some people just have no social protocol, social etiquette. You've met these people. It will happen. It will happen. So first, you know, it could be a small correction. It could be someone that's talking too much. It could be someone that's taking a cell phone call in the middle of your presentation. That's heckling. Those are things that are throwing you off. Most people are just clueless. They have no idea. It's 100 people in the room, and they're talking on the cell phone, not realizing that they're disrupting everybody. There are some hecklers that will do it on purpose. So I'm going to give you three stages to handle a heckler. And 90% of the time, you're going to use stage one. Stage one, let's talk about someone asking too many questions or the annoying person. What should you do? I think stage one, just very basic. And stage one is saying, hello, you are annoying, okay? Without saying that. Calling to attention that what they're doing is probably not the best thing they could do. So if somebody throws a comment at you that's offensive some way, what's the best way to handle it? You have to be careful. We've talked about you can't slam a heckler unless the audience is on your side. Guy was speaking, and this guy was just, he didn't know he's the CEO, but he was just slamming him and just heckling him. Guy was just drunk off his rear. And so he slammed him and told him to get out and leave. And he did, and so did the rest of the audience. So he's there by himself, wondering who's going to pay his bill. But anyway, found out later that the drunk guy was the CEO whose wife had died 2 weeks earlier in an automobile accident. I mean, obviously he didn't know those things, but he didn't obviously sense when the audience is on your, I mean, that's like kind of a no-win situation, but you have to sense when the audience is on your side. But stage one could be a smile. You could ignore it. You know, the first couple of times you might ignore it, the people around them will, especially a spouse or a girlfriend, will help people realize that they're being lame. You know, sometimes when you look at a spouse, especially if someone starts snoring, just a quick look and they'll get the elbow. Okay. A glance. It could be even a touch. If somebody's talking too much and just walking out of the audience and just a simple touch on the shoulder. These are just easy things that you're calling attention that they are disrupting the group, and most people will stop. Be courteous, and a lot of times it's as simple as, excuse me, I didn't hear you. What did you say? Or what did you hear growing up? You want to share that with the group? I mean, what do most people say? You know, we just don't. And for the most part, it works. Excuse me, I didn't hear you. For most people, that'll say, well, because it's usually a snide remark underneath your breath to your friend, so, and, you know, everyone laughs. Or you can say something like, I wish I had a lower IQ so I could appreciate that one, but that's not necessarily the best thing. Okay, so don't get shocked, angry. And when he heckles you, be relaxed, be calm, know that it's coming, and it's not going to bother you, and, you know, kind of think of a solution. You know, what's the easiest thing? So avoid confrontation. You know, always offer your help. Be patient with them. And at stage two, one thing you can do is to call a break. Pull them aside and talk to them one-on-one. Say, look, you know, I'm having a hard time here. I'm appreciating your comments, but, you know, you're kind of really throwing me off here. Could you help me out here and not do X or whatever they're doing? So actually talk to them face-to-face. Or if you know they're going to be there, there's always one person. You can just plan with the person that's in charge. And when that person gets out of hand, the person in charge will come down and say, excuse me, I have a phone call. Pull them out, lock the door, and send them home. Without a commotion. I mean, you don't really want a commotion. Stage three, I mean, this is going to happen, you know, less than 1% of the time. You're confronting them, you're calling security, the audience is on your side. And you've felt that before, a person in the class that asks too many questions, right, and just the tension when the hand goes up. Have you felt that before? Yeah. That, you know, the audience is on your side and say, look, I'm tired of your questions. Get out of here. Ask them to leave. Most of the time, if you ask them to leave, they might give you anything, but when you pick up that phone to call security, they're going to pick up their bags and leave. And the audience is on your side. Humor is a great way to handle a heckler. Let it know that it's not getting to you. Because when somebody does a sharp, stabbing remark at you, you and the audience, what are you doing? I see how he's going to handle that one. Right? Aren't you kind of excited going, uh-huh, let's see how he handles it. Isn't that what you're doing? Let's see how he's handled it. And that's part of it. And so everyone's looking to you. The type of reaction, how you're going to handle it. Is it going to upset you? Are you in control? Are you still smiling? Can you use humor? You know, humor works very, very well. Thinking on your feet. Some things you would never say to a heckler is, you know, like, you wouldn't understand. What does that say to somebody? You're stupid. I mean, you're stupid. Calm down. What does that tell somebody? Yeah, you're out of control. It's none of your business would be another one. What's your problem? But, you know, the rookie's natural inclination is just to slam somebody back because it feels so good. You know, when somebody slams you and makes fun of your mother or whatever it is, sometimes it just feels good to slam back, but as the speaker, you can't do that. You'll lose too many points. Too many points. Yeah, in a lot of ways you can. I mean, if there's a baby crying and the parent's oblivious that it's making everybody tense, you can say something, man, I can't believe I'm being heckled by a two-year-old. Chuckle. And then the mother's like, hello? Oh. And then she'll take off. And that was kind of a tactful, humorous way for me to let you know, look, your kid's driving us nuts. Get him out of here. And if I would have done that, I would have lost more points. Like, you know, the kid, and everyone loves the kid. But, you know, bottom line, driving us nuts. So a simple thing like that, you could handle that way. Definitely. Have fun with it. All right, any questions on that? Let's talk about critical aspects, preparing your speech, beginning your speech. The most important, how many seconds do you have before somebody turns off? Around 30 seconds. Something that really helps you out with your introduction, and I mean, if there's some part of your speech that you have down pat, it's your introduction, because it gives you confidence, it gives you control. Because, you know, once you start getting into a speech, a lot of times it's much easier to speak. And sometimes it's easy to interact with the people you're going to speak to beforehand, and, you know, what, obviously what you eat, you know, spinach dip is a bad thing to eat before you speak. Sodas out, obviously. Milk products. Cold water. All some things you just kind of watch out for. You know, like carbonation especially. So this is your first regression. It's very difficult to recover. So, an opener is designed to get people to listen more and to capture their attention. You're grabbing the attention of the audience, and you must earn it. We've talked about this before. Your audience is rooting for you. They didn't come to be bored. They didn't come to be upset. They came to be motivated. They came to be edified. They came to be inspired. They came for something. Even if you have to be there and you're forced to be there, it would be nice to at least be worth your while. And so you do need to earn it, and they want to make sure that it appeals to them. And so it's important for you to state the importance of your topic and grab their attention. How do you grab someone's attention? You're up there speaking. You're doing the opening. How are you going to grab an audience's attention? You could, I mean, you want to startle them. It could be a statistic. It could be a quote. You could be clear in your throat. It could be a joke or a story. But, you know, arouse their curiosity. And, of course, we've said it a million times. What is the word? What's in it for me? You know, you got to be able to do that, to relate it to them. You say something like, you know, 3 ways to double your income in 60 days. Quote, story, personal experience. Make sure it's dramatic because you have 30 seconds. You want to pack a serious punch. And, of course, you want to establish that you care. We've seen speeches that, you know, really grateful to be here. I love every single one of you. And deep down you're going, yeah, right. So, you know, you want to establish that you care. And ways you do that is that you've done your research on the audience. You know about them. You know their concerns. Give them a reason to listen and establish a common bond. That you're just not some outsider, but you actually have a common bond with them. And, of course, humor works out very, very well. The things that I do notice with rookies when they start speaking is the use of transitions. We organize in clusters, so it's important that you... Does everyone know what a transition is? It's an example of a transition. Yeah. And that leads me to, now that we've talked about that, just make sure that there's transitions of those things that you want to put ahead of time. With that, make sure you're revealing the topic of your speech. Do not say, today I'm going to speak on. That's been done too many times, and it's just, they should know what you're speaking on without having you say that. Establish your credibility. Now, credibility is a big issue, because when you're braggadocious, you're bragging about yourself, what does the audience do? Is that a word? No? It sounds good, though, doesn't it? When you're braggadocious, look it up. Scrabble, 112 points. I mean, what do you think of a sermon that kind of comes across, well, I've done this, I've published this, and I've done this, and what's the audience do? And so it really brings them down. Now, the best thing you can do as a speaker is to have someone introduce you, get an introduction. Because when someone else says they're published this and done this and this, and that's okay. But if you do it yourself, you have to be careful. So if you need to establish credibility, have nobody introduce yourself, how can you do that? Let's say you have a doctorate from Harvard. You know, I say, well, I have my doctorate from Harvard, might be able to come across. How could you have that come across without being braggadocious? You know, as I was at Harvard University studying on my my graduate work or studying this. Sure, so same thing. Yeah, it's probably the easiest way to do it in a story or something like to establish that credibility. You know, I had a lot of struggles writing my first book, and, you know, I was doing this, and just kind of put it into a story, and it's the same type of credibility is there, because the guy goes, oh, he's got a doctor from Harvard, versus then they're coming up with their own solutions. So be very, very careful with that. Now, your introduction is about 10% of your speech, 10%. Again, a quote, rhetorical question, story, a joke, you know, whatever it is, works out very, very, very well. So I'd spend more time with that. Now, the opposite of that is the conclusion. Two functions. We need to know that you're ending, and we need to know what you want us to do. We should never have to guess when to applause. Good conclusion. You should, like, that was the end. I know it's the end. You can do that with vocal inflection, a few other things. So don't do it too fast. Of course, we all know, we've said a million times, what to tell me when you've got over? You haven't practiced? And you don't care about us. Don't take us by surprise. Best type of ending is emotional. And it's usually about 5% of your speed. And we don't want you saying, well, that's it. All I have. I'm out of time. I should probably stop. Those aren't things that aren't going to give you a lot of credibility. Quotes also work very well. Might want to refer to your introduction. Pay the audience a compliment, a laugh, or, you know, a brief story. One that I've used before that actually works pretty well when you talk about personal development and success. I tell my story about a group of turkeys. The audience kind of looks up like, you're talking about us? So it's about a group of turkeys, and these turkeys were excited because they were going to go to a 3-day turkey convention on how to become better turkeys. How to become better turkeys. There's full-day classes on getting better dates, getting better food, but there's a full-day class on learning how to fly. These turkeys were excited. They were going to learn how to fly because most turkeys choose not to fly, but they realize if they could learn to fly, it would change their life. They'd get better dates. They would get past Thanksgiving. I mean, it would make them more successful turkeys, and that's what they're excited about. So they went to the class. They saw the videotapes of takeoff and landings, the touch and goes, and at the end of the day, they went outside, and they were practicing and practicing, and by the end of the day, these turkeys, they were soaring with the eagles. They were excited. Eagles were a little bit nervous, but these turkeys, they were soaring with the eagles, and this skill was going to change their life. This skill was going to make them the type of turkeys they wanted to become. Conference came to a close. They came to landing. They said their goodbyes. They handed out their business cards, and then they all walked home. They all walked home. Now, that's not something that's getting a chuckle, but it's what you do in your mind. All right, just gets you to think, and so that type of conclusion works very, very well. I've used that quite a bit, and that is one that worked very well for me. Retention. So we're going to talk about visual aids, gathering materials, supporting materials, of course. Visual aids increase retention by 25 times. Repetition the first time, 10%, six times, 90%. Now, when I say repetition, sometimes it gets annoying when the person says the same thing over and over again. It's okay to repeat, but sometimes you want to repackage. You can say the same thing five or six different times in different ways. You can say it in a story. You can say it in a statistic. I'm going to give the examples on goal setting. I said the same thing probably five or six different ways, and that increases the retention. And you've seen this one before, that 20% of what we hear, 30% of what we see, 50% of what we see and hear, and of course 80% of what we see, hear, and do. One of the main things you want with your presentation is to develop a theme or a retention tool, and make sure you always give old material new slant. If you go do a lot of success or motivation, you always hear about, anybody know who Roger Bannister is? You heard that story? You guys got to get out more. Anyway, if you went to a lot of personal development seminars, you hear about Roger Bannister. You know, everybody said you couldn't break the 4-minute mile. Mm-hmm. Even in Greece, you've heard this one, right? Yeah. They put lions chasing you couldn't break the 4-minute mile. And then Roger Bannister broke it. Then after that, so did hundreds of other people. You know, that's kind of, you need to be able to be careful of those, because you need to repackage those, because when you hear it, you kind of tend to tune out. So, visual aids. 80% of our human motivation is optically stimulated. We're going to talk about colors and a few other things, but your visual aids, I'm going to give you a few examples. They need to grab attention and strengthen your message. They need to increase interest. And the biggest one is easy to read. The biggest mistake, your font size is too small. Now, you have to be careful with the world of visual aids and PowerPoint, because sometimes, you ever seen a PowerPoint presentation that was so, you know, things flying in and audio, and it just was just too much? Things true with visual aids. Never have one more than one slide in PowerPoint or one overhead per minute. That's kind of the general rule, because otherwise it's just too much, it's overload. But visual aids do increase your persuasiveness as a speaker by over 40%. So they do work, and it's important, because being in the MTV generation, and we want visual aids, and so you want to do those. But you can also use props. You can use yourself. You can use photographs, flip charts, handouts are for when? The very end, okay? Talked about that. Graphs, slide projectors. Videotapes work very well. They might work in your presentations. Make sure they're short and concise. So visual aids, prepare them in advance. Make sure they're easy to understand. Your colors work well together. And 36 point, I think the standard is like a quarter inch high. Isn't that about 36? About a quarter inch is what you're looking for. And the tricky thing with the visual aid or writing on the chalkboard is what? What would you guess?
Your back.
Your back. You never, sometimes you can't avoid it, but you never want to get your back to the audience, ever. Research was done at the University of Minnesota. The better presenter you were was a direct correlation to your visual support. And they found that color is one of the biggest reasons presentations have such enormous power. So what colors do you use? What colors don't look well together? Red and purple? Would you use pink? Pink be a good color for you? Yes, depending on who you're presenting to. I won't go on that. But anyway, red is a power color, but you need to be careful because red means what to some people? What's that? Blood, anger, stop. Green's supposed to stimulate interaction. And I'm just throwing these out. I mean, there's been a lot of study on colors. For example, black can mean death or loyalty. Green could be envy. Red's passion. Orange is warmth. Purple is royalty. I want to spend a little time, and we talk about success skills and successful people. The Carnegie Institute of Technology did a study as far as what made people successful and working with people. 85% of your success in life comes from your people skills. Anybody buy that? Is that true? Is it more important than what you know? You know, most people are fired and downsized because their inability to work with people. We've spent some time talking about that, but great speakers do that. But what are some of the basic people skills? Understand, empathy, listening, remembering names and a few other things. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. That's something that you need to do. But probably the most important thing you can learn in life is getting along with people and working with people and developing rapport. What is rapport? Kind of an instant relationship almost. An instant kind of relationship. And have you ever, you know, you meet people and you like to be around them? You ever met someone for the first time and you just had things in common and you were talking and you liked it? This was neat. And another person, you just kind of met him, and you're like, right? That's rapport. That's people skills. I mean, some people just rub you the wrong way, and, you know, some people just don't have these skills, right? There's a degree of success when you can read people's facial skills and understand what they're feeling. In fact, women, have you ever been out with someone, you gave them all the clues? You're not kissing me tonight. You wouldn't hold their hand. You wouldn't look them in the face. You gave them all the signals. Every single one. You did down the checklist. Check, check, check. And you went to the door, and what did they try to do? Hello? Right? You gave them all the signals. You wouldn't talk to them. You were mean to them. You wouldn't hold their hand. You're at the movie theater doing this, right? But still, and, you know, this is true, male and female. Some people just socially aren't able to, you know, interpret your facial signals, interpret your nonverbal skills, and that's all part of success. I mean, and as speakers, you have to be able to read that and understand they're feeling uncomfortable. They're not liking me. I need to change some of the things that I'm doing. And some people are just like, all right, let's talk. Spend just a few moments on trust. You need to get people to trust you. And there's the four, we'll talk about the four C's to trust. It's actually five, but we'll talk. Because if you're speaking, you want people to do things, you need to trust them. The first, the bottom level of trust is character. And that's what most people think about trust. Character, integrity, and honesty. You know, who you are. Can they trust you? Next rung on the ladder is competence. This is your knowledge and your ability. Let me give you an example. Let's say I move into town and I have a terrible toothache and I need you to recommend a dentist. I don't know any dentists. And I talk to you, he says, you know what, you know a great dentist. belongs to my church group, great character. Great character. Just not very competent. You know, last time I was there, he stuck a needle through my cheek. Great character. Would you go to that dentist?
No.
No way. Well, no. I know another dentist. Very competent. Graduated top in his class. He just doesn't have much character. Tends to put in 3 or 4 more feelings than you actually need. You know, it tends to overbill quite a bit, too. To go to that dentist. See the balance between the two? And you have to make sure that you're consistent. This is you being congruent and credible. You need to be congruent and credible. Consistent. Meaning, if you're sitting in the chair and the dentist says, you know what? Molar number 5. I don't know if that exists, but no. You're going to need a root canal in 6 months. So come back in 6 months. We'll go ahead and give you a root canal. And you come back 6 months later and say, Doc, what about that molar? Don't I need a root canal? And he says, what root canal? Your teeth look fine to me. Who told you need a root canal? Whoa. Red flag. Being consistent. Congruence. Credible. And the last top of the list is confidence. Conviction and belief. When we study in persuasion, one of the laws of power that we talk about is actually being bold. Have you met people that just act like they know what they're talking about and people just automatically follow them? But after a while, sometimes you see through it and you don't follow them anymore. But being confident, having conviction and belief. Remember that dentist came in and he sat you down and he put up the x-ray, says, I don't know, you take a look at your x-ray. I'm thinking you might need a root canal. What do you think? I'm thinking root canal, or maybe we can just leave it for a while. What do you think? Red flag. So part of having that trust is having the character, the competence, the knowledge and ability, the license for you to speak, meaning I know my stuff, being consistent and being confident with your conviction and your belief. And that is the 4 C's of trust. And that's part of trust is only telling people as much as they will believe. I don't care if you have the best story or the best statistic. If people don't believe it, don't tell it. That makes sense? I mean, when you say, what's the one statistic? 98% of all home-based businesses are successful. You believe it? Well, it's true after 5 years, but it's just too much, too soon if people don't believe it. And never assume that people believe you. It's something that you have to earn. Tell the truth even if it hurts. Have you ever studied Volkswagen and some of their advertising?
No, not yet.
Their first advertising was just truthful. It says, this car, what was it? This car is ugly, it looks like a beetle. And the other one was, this car is so slow, you'll be lucky if you ever get a ticket. You know, what did Volvo use? Remember Volvo's? I think it was like, ugly but safe. When you're telling truth, sometimes you can tell some of your weaknesses because that actually gives you more credibility. Does that make sense? When you say some of your weaknesses, you'll actually have more credibility. And another part of trust, and this is interesting, and we learn this in persuasion, is use the power of the printed word. That's why overheads and visuals are so powerful in handouts, because as a society, if it's printed, we believe it. If it's on the internet, we believe it for the most part. In fact, it was Delaware. Anybody here from Delaware? Been to Delaware? Not a big state. And so they did a little joke, and they put a sign that says, closed. State of Delaware. It was closed. And people would pull over, they're turning around, they're going, well, how long is it closed, right? Because people believe the power of the printed word. It's just one of those amazing things. They put it in print, people believe it, and so that actually helps your trust. Now, there's 3 types of credibility as a speaker. Initial, that's before you come out. What is your credibility? Are you an author? Are you a speaker? Are you a professor? Do we not know you? Your reputation. There's derived. That's everything you say during a speech. Because credibility can go up and down during a speech. And the third is terminal. That's your credibility at the end of the speech. And, you know, credibility and trust is in the mind of the audience. So know your stuff. Remember, you are the expert. If you're speaking, you're the expert. Initial, derived, and terminal. So that is in the eyes of the beholder.